when the U.S. Embassy in Iran was seized. This afternoon on Fresh Air at 4 o'clock, we'll be joined by Bruce Langan, who was one of the 53 Americans held hostage in Iran from November of 79 through January of 81. He was the ranking U.S. official at the embassy. Langan is now the vice president of the National Defense University and ambassador at large for counterterrorism. We'll discuss current efforts to combat terrorism, and we'll review his experiences while held hostage in Iran when he joins us at 4 o'clock. Mo Feinberg, the president of the Three Stooges fan club and brother of Stooge Larry, died Monday at the age of 51. Mo Feinberg grew up in Philadelphia. Mo and Larry both got their starts in vaudeville, but Mo left show business to settle down and become a window dresser while brother Larry became a stooge. At 3:30, we'll remember Philadelphian Mo Feinberg with an interview that we recorded last year about the early days of vaudeville and about the Three Stooges. Coping with loss is the subject of Judith Viorst's new book, Necessary Losses. She writes about how losses we experience frequently force us to grow. She says when we think of loss through death, but we also experience loss by leaving or being left by people we love, by relinquishing impossible ideals and illusions, and by aging when our strength and vitality diminishes. Viorst has written several humorous books for adults and for children, including How Did I Get to Be 40 and Other Atrocities. She's also a contributing editor to Redbook. She wrote her new book after spending 6 years studying at the Psychoanalytic Institute in Washington, D.C. Her new book, Necessary Losses, is published by Simon & Schuster. Welcome back to Fresh Air. Nice to
see
you again.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Why did you want to go to the Washington Psychoanalytic Institute? Because you already had a very good career as a writer and author.
Well, I suppose it was my wish to grow and move on. I'd been writing all of my writing life about people's feelings and wishes and needs and anxieties. And I've been writing about that for children and for adults out of my own direct experiences, out of the experiences of my friends as they told me about them, from eavesdropping. I'm a world-class eavesdropper. And a piece was missing, and that piece was the theoretical underpinnings, the explanation in terms of human psychology of why we do what we do. What are the defenses, anxieties, techniques that can be understood psychologically? I decided I wanted to learn about that in school, not to come out and write a textbook, but the way you might, having listened to music for a long time, take an intensive course in music appreciation and learn that a symphony has four parts, and then be able to listen to that symphony with heightened perception. I went to school for 6 years to heighten my perceptions. It was quite an experience.
Well, you were, at least for the final year, I think, the only layperson in the class. Was there a lot of jargon or assumptions that you really resisted while you were studying there?
It was an interesting class. For the 6 years, actually, that I was there, the class was made up of 9 people. The other 8 of them were men, 12 years younger, MDs, psychiatrists. I went into it thinking that I was going to be the literary figure in the classroom, introducing everybody to Dostoevsky and Philip Roth and T.S. Eliot, and the doctors would teach me about psychiatry and I would teach them about literature. Well, it didn't work out that way. These were very smart guys. Many of them had majored in philosophy or had an art major when they were in college. They all knew about Dostoevsky and et cetera. And they all had a sense of humor. It was a very unjargony experience. They were a welcoming and irreverent group of people who took me in. I used to go up to my teachers after class and whisper questions in their ear because I figured everybody else knew the answers. And one of the guys pulled me aside and said, "Judy, you're asking all your questions after class because you think we all know the answers. We don't know the answers. Please ask your questions in class so we can find them out too." So it was wonderful. I didn't. It isn't a religion. It's an inquiry. And you don't have to buy the whole package. You wrestle with ideas, with Freud's ideas and all of the, Winnicott and Kernberg and Coe had a whole realm of of thinkers in the field of psychoanalytic theory.
As part of your training, you underwent psychoanalysis. Had you never done it before?
I had had some experiences with therapy at other times in my life, but this was real lie down on the couch four times a week psychoanalysis, and it's a much different process. It's among other things, one of my running jokes was that you really need a psychoanalyst and a psychotherapist. The therapist sort of tell you what to do on a day-to-day basis, but the psychoanalyst to leave you to wrestle with your deep issues, basically on your own. You don't get a lot of advice. I consider it one of the great learning, growing, small miracles of my life to have experienced psychoanalysis.
Did you make any big changes in your life afterwards?
I think that the huge change, and I can't really separate psychoanalysis from this whole experience of the psychoanalytic training, was my ability to give up the hard-edged on-off black-white either-or answers of my girlhood and to really learn on a very deep level to live with ambiguity and ambivalence, to live in a world that's both black and white, to accept the fact that I'm loving and hating, to understand that, you know, that we're all good and bad, that the answer to most questions isn't A or B or C, but all of the above. That is a big difference. The other thing, which I just think is so valuable for anybody experiencing psychoanalysis, is what all of us do to some extent is we hold at bay a lot of aspects of ourselves. We don't want to know about them. We don't want to look in, we don't want to look there. They scare us. We take our two hands and we push them against the door, and on the other side of that door is all the stuff we don't want to look at. In analysis, you stop pushing against that door. You do look inside. Usually when you put all those things inside that door, you were much younger. They seem very big and overwhelming. They're not so big and overwhelming now. You can take them in. And all the energy that you have used, those two hands pushing against that door, is now freed to use for yourself, to use for other people, to use out in the world, to not just be a happier person, but to be a more giving, available to others person.
My guest is writer Judith Viorst. I guess you put some of that energy into writing your new book, and the theme of the book is how we grow through the process of loss. Why did loss become the subject of your book?
Well, I kept on encountering it. You know, as you said earlier, I do use the word in a very broadened definition. But it seemed to me that everywhere I look, people were struggling with issues of loss, whether it was the loss of having somebody's undivided love, as you see with kids as they're struggling with the new arrival of the new baby, people dealing with loss of freedom as they acquire a conscience and a sense of guilt and they can't go out and do whatever they damn please because they feel guilty. People dealing with all kinds of losses having to do with their expectations in marriage and as a parent. And we're all dealing with loss. We're all dealing with it. And we're all, if we're thinking about our lives and working a little bit on our lives, we're all very often growing through these losses and getting stuck if we don't use them as growth-promoting experiences.
One of the things you describe as a loss is when your children are grown up and they leave home, which is something that you've experienced with, I think, two of your three children.
And my third one has just left, and it is not easy. I mean, I like many parents, I really see myself. I saw myself. I guess I still see myself as some kind of shield of invulnerability between them and life's dangers. My oldest son is 24. I still somehow have the fantasy that it'll be safer when he crosses the street if he's holding my hand. I am full of advice and helpful hints and ways of doing things that I would like to lay on my children all the time. And I struggle to leave them be. I remember how I felt at 24 when my mother was calling me up and giving me advice. you have to give that up if you're going to get. You have to make that mommy child shift if you're going to start getting something resembling a friendship move, a respectful friendship between two adults. It's hard.
Did you experience any sense of liberation when they grew up and left too, because you'd have more time to yourself? And I don't know.
Yes, I did. I did. In fact, I was sort of embarrassed because I did feel very sad. My youngest son, Alexander, who is in his first year of college now, is, you know, just when he was home, there were six other kids there too, because all of his friends. So you don't just lose that last child; you lose kids. All of a sudden, it's just the grown-ups. On the other hand, my husband and I spent our whole married life being parents. We became parents immediately. We never had any, you know, we got instantly pregnant, and we never had any time, just the two of us, to be a husband and wife. And let me tell you, it's really nice. And I was ashamed to find one weekend that my husband and I had counted on for a very cozy time together. I was ashamed when my kid called up and said he wanted to come home that weekend. And I said, do you really want to come home? And I couldn't believe that this is me. Could I be a good mother and feel that way? So sure, there is some positive stuff in that.
Do you talk about this with them, or do you want to like protect your children from what you're going through because of their leaving home?
I actually talk to them about a lot of things now. That has been, I mean, that is the gain from the loss. The loss was being their protective mother and sort of shielding them and watching over them. The gain has been this increasing ease in conversation with them, of revealing more of myself instead of always being, you know, strong and sturdy. And my husband does that too. We've let them get to know us in increasingly deeper ways, and it's very nice. Have you asked their advice?
Really?
Yes, and they're pretty good.
Have you been using this as a time to stand back and critique yourself as a parent and look back at all the things that you did over the years?
Oh, yes. Oh, Lord. I keep on saying to myself, if I could, right now, I think I could really do it perfect. I think, you know, why don't I, if I could just start now. But the fact is that that's another illusion that we have to give up, that there is some kind of, that there was some, ever, any kind of recipe for child raising, that there really ever was, is some list that if you followed this list, you would produce perfect children if you said this and did this and went here and didn't do that. That, you know, that notion that we have that much power, that's another necessary loss. We don't have that kind of power to shape our children. And we get children who come into the world with different strengths and weaknesses and coping capacities and temperaments. And we can be perfect, and we still may not produce perfect children. So that my fantasy, if I was perfect, everybody would just be totally 100% happy. I know that's nonsense, and I'm in the process of sort of forgiving myself my various dopey mothering mistakes and saying, look at these three great guys that you've produced.
You know what I'd like to know? If you envy your children growing up in the times that they do or not, because they're going to have to confront when they're ready to get married, if they want to do that, or have a family if they want to do that. They're going to be confronting very different kinds of social issues than the ones you did.
I do not envy my children growing up now. I feel so sad about this world that we are leaving our children, that I can practically cry over it. I grew up in a New Jersey suburb where I didn't own a key, because just the door was never locked. My mother never knew. She knew one person who was divorced. She never knew anybody who was raped, murdered, or robbed. I walked around streets of New York when I moved to Greenwich Village at 2 in the morning, feeling perfectly safe. The world has gotten so much more brutal since my growing up times that, and I now live in a house with a burglar alarm, and I lock it during the day. And I know people who have been murdered and raped, and God knows, I can't even count the number, robbed. I raise my children with a level of wariness that I never had to have. And this is just domestic. This is just the difference in the domestic world. The world outside our borders has just gotten so menacing. They have a lot of freedoms. We've given our kids many more opportunities and wonderful schools and us loving, devoted, always there people. But I think we haven't given them a good world, and that makes me very sad.
Another thing that they're going to have to confront is the impermanence of families, because I think when you were getting married, it was assumed that you just stayed married. That's what most people did,
that's
really changed. Families have become very impermanent.
Yeah. Though I must say that I certainly push families in a big way, and even though outside our immediate circle of friends there are a lot of divorces and breakups, we have a core of friends who have stayed together over a period of 25 years. Our kids, I'm knocking wood, our kids have role models among our immediate friends of people that they've known the kids all their lives. They've seen these families together. They've seen people who really thrive on married life. I hope that I have, and Milton has conveyed to them that sometimes you have to hang in there even when things aren't easy and aren't fun, and that and that commitment and a sense of responsibility may give them more joy ultimately than doing their own thing. I think they have come to value married life and continued family life. What I'm hoping is that they will, in their 20s, have a couple of relationships, in which maybe they even live with the girls. At 30, get married, stay married forever, and stay faithful. That is my hope for them.
My guest is writer Judith Viorst, and her new book is titled Necessary Losses. Another loss that you address in the book is losing your youth. And this is a subject that you've been writing about for many years now.
Well, it's a long process.
Yeah, but no, I think back to your book, How Did I Get to Be 40 and Other Atrocities, which was written over 10 years ago.
That's right. You've been counting, you cruel woman.
So when you look back, does 40 seem like very old to you now? Does it seem as old as it did then?
Certainly not. Practically teenage. No. It doesn't seem, but actually I'm in my 50s, and that doesn't seem as old as I used to think it was either. And when I wrote the book on the 40s, and I used to go around and talk about it, and I was sort of very much in the middle of the struggle of, as I was acquiring the sagging kneecaps and the laugh lines that seemed to be permanent, and the sense of, you know, all the open-ended options weren't so open-ended anymore. I would go around and talk about this at different women's groups. Every time somebody would come over to me and say, "Darling, wait till you hit 50. It's really going to get better. You're going to assimilate this all." I thought, well, and it's true. It is absolutely true. You do, again, get to the other side of that. And the women I know, and I would even say the woman I am, have gains that far exceed their losses. I think we're not as self-centered as we used to be. We have a sense of perspective about ourselves. Things they aren't tragic. We can laugh at them. We've cried, but now we can laugh at them. And I think we have a more gentle, forgiving attitude toward our own imperfections and other people's. I think we're better ladies now than when we were 10 years ago.
You've written about self-improvement as a distraction from aging, because you keep thinking, oh, I'll put it off by jogging or exercising or eating right or whatever. Do you still think of it as Do you still think that people sometimes fool themselves by just throwing themselves whole hog into some self-improvement
into frenzied activity? Yeah, I mean, I think I am all in favor of self-improvement. I think it's terrific, but I think it can be a substitute for the inner improvement that requires a little time to stop, think, assimilate, live through your experience. And, you know, there are people who are always running, running, running from one activity to the other. And that's what I was spoofing. A little self, you know, I'd still like to learn French someday.
How are you dealing with the vanity questions about aging? You know, laugh lines and possible gray hairs and things like that. Does stuff like that bother you in the way you thought it was going to? Does it bother you more or less than you thought it was going to?
It bothered me more than it now bothers me. I mean, I have a different vision of myself. For a while, you know, I thought of myself as this pretty young woman, and I'm not a young woman anymore. I am a pretty middle-aged woman. Nobody would mistake me for a young girl. And I really had to let go of that whole vision of myself as, you know, as a cute young thing. Sometimes when I'm getting off an airplane and I watch a man carry the suitcase of some husky, gorgeous young girl who could carry it herself, and here I am with lower back pain thinking I wish he would carry mine. I think it, you know, gentlemen prefer blondes and young. But most of the time, I look in the mirror and I say, well, you know, not bad for where you are right now. And I don't have to be a beauty. I don't have to have that kind of attention to define me or to think well of myself.
Was there a point in your life where you started realizing that you were actually going to get old at some point? Because there's the abstract realization, but then there's the real actual knowledge of it.
Yeah. No, it really did take me a long time to realize that. I mean, I remember thinking that different people were assigned to different age slots, and and there was sort of this permanent cast of people who were old. I now have, and I think when you hit midlife, you really do confront, you know, transience and mortality, and the fact that you will, you know, somewhere between here and death, you will pass through old age if you, you know, if you go on long enough. And I have certainly been, I have very good friends in their 70s and 80s and 90s. People who are my friends, and I am very interested in, I mean, one of the things I've done in this book is all through it I'm talking about people's lives and what they do with themselves at different stages. So in the chapter on old age, I've got it full of all these people that I know or read about or interviewed who are models for me and hopefully other people on how you could get to be a terrific old lady. It's not easy, but it's not impossible.
What's your model for how you'd like to turn out?
Well, the first thing that I really like that I've seen among the people I know, I have one very dear friend who is in her 70s, is that she has friends in every age category. That if she's going to the movies even going on a trip, she might go with a 50-year-old. She might go with a 20-year-old. She is a warm fireplace around which people want to gather. And she has stories to tell and wisdom to impart and a wonderful capacity for listening. So she isn't just doing a cute little old lady number. She's also listening. So I even now have started really reaching out to people younger than I, have started becoming friends with some of my friends' daughters. And I want to have friends of every decade in my life. And I want to be somebody who, in some relationships, is the teacher, sharing what I know. In some relationships, is still the learner, listening and taking in what other people know. In addition to kind of equal, rueful exchanges with people of my own age, I want to have, and have been increasingly having men friends, guys who are my friends. I have one of the men from the Institute who is my kids referred to as the brother you never had, who is so that I started. My first answer, of course, has to do with people, keeping people in my life, a whole range of people. I think that's very, very important. And I pray for good health. I have been interested in the fact that even people with bad health, unless it is really devastating and I can't address myself to the things over which we have zero control, that there are different attitudes you can take toward your health. I think I quote Paul Claudel, who's a French writer in his 80s. He said, 80 years old, no eyes, no legs, no wind, no hearing. It's amazing how well one can do without them. This is a very positive attitude. I would love to have some of that.
At the beginning of the interview today, you described how you wanted to go to the Psychoanalytic Institute to kind of get the details of what you'd kind of known but hadn't really studied about,
right.
Anxieties and neuroses and things like that. Well, having gone through that training and now written your book, Necessary Losses, do you feel like that's helped you cope any better? Has that theoretical training helped you deal with your own?
Yes, I think I have. I mean, I always knew it, but it really has underscored for me the fact that we are pushed in powerful ways by forces outside of our awareness that shape our actions, that we repeat and repeat responses to things over and over again, caught up in the same, sometimes damaging or dopey patterns. And that to be able to stop and struggle to make conscious these patterns doesn't transform you, but it puts it on the agenda for you where you can wrestle with it, modify it, and maybe eventually transform it.
Okay, I want to thank you very much for being with us today. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
My guest has been writer Judith Viorst, and her new book is titled Necessary Losses, and it's published by Simon & Schuster. She also is a contributing editor to our Red Book magazine, and has written several other books, some for adults, some for children. It's 3:30. This is Fresh Air, and you tune to WHYY-FM in Philadelphia. At 4 o'clock today, we'll be joined by Bruce Langan, who was the senior ranking officer in the U.S. Embassy when the embassy was seized and the people there held hostage. And he's now speaking on the subject of terrorism, which we'll be discussing with him when he joins us at 4 o'clock this afternoon. Larry of the Three Stooges, he's the one with the frizzy hair, grew up in Philadelphia, and since his death in 1975, his memory has been kept alive by his brother, Mo Feinberg, who also grew up in Philadelphia and lived most of his life in the Philadelphia area. He also headed the Three Stooges fan club. Mo Feinberg died on Monday of this week at the age of 81. We're going to remember him by listening to an interview that we recorded last year right after he'd written a book about the Three Stooges. Before we hear that interview, let's hear a recording of the Three Stooges.
Hey, fellas, let's sing a song.
Okay.